Yes, indeed. Now, normally, I say on a Friday afternoon that there's going to be people air guitaring or air drumming. I bet a few of you air bassing there, slapping your hips alongside Tony Franklin. That was roundabout. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from California, the fretless monster himself, ladies and gentlemen, Tony Franklin. Tony, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome.
Tony, that was from a YouTube video that I caught online. It's been an interesting time for a musician, hasn't it? Because of what's been going on both sides of the pond. What was, as we call it, this, that, and the other, otherwise known as the virus.
Very well put. Yes, yes. I mean, you know, my musical life typically consists of being on the road and then working from home. And I do a lot of recording sessions and stuff and stay very active when I'm at home. And so really that hasn't changed too much for me. I'm happy and thankful to say. I mean, obviously there's not been any touring or live gigs, but I've been pretty active and getting into some things that I needed to spend some time on, some writing and of all sorts. So, you know, it's an unusual time for sure. But musicians, especially when we've been around a while, we get resourceful, we get busy, we get creative, and that's what we do.
I mean, take me back to the beginnings then, Tony. You're originally from Derbyshire. How did you get into music, and why the noble bass?
Oh, boy, that's we could be here for a couple of hours on that question, but I will keep it short. Born into a big musical family, my parents were playing a gig the night before I was born in the Rising Sun pub in Willington, Derby. It's still there. So I was born in a pub called the Rising Sun. And so music was just part of my life from a very early age. I played with their band from 5 years old and just was immersed in music. The whole family, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, everyone. And so it just carried on from there. And this was, I was born in 62. And so by the time I was 10, 12, 14, all that, it was the 70s. There were gigs everywhere. We played 3 weeks straight sometimes, just doing covers, sometimes back in cabaret, sometimes doing a lead spot ourselves. It was fantastic. And so I had a ton of experience. And the bass came along. Well, I was playing other instruments. I could read from a very young age, courtesy of my dad. And then my parents had a rehearsal with their band. I'd be 11 or so years old. And I wasn't in on the rehearsal. They were working up a new guitarist, and I wasn't in on the rehearsal. So I was incredibly bored, only child, making a nuisance of myself, wanted a lot of attention. And so my mom pulled out this bass that I knew she'd played at some point, but I couldn't remember seeing it, and said, "Hey, try this." And it was instant. I mean, it's like, whoa, it was like the heavenly choir started singing and the light shining down from the clouds and, oh, and it's like, well, I knew this was the instrument I've been waiting for. Everything made sense about it. Everything I'd done before. It was instant. I was playing gigs on it 3 days later. And so it just went from there and kept on playing different opportunities. And it just kind of all led from there, just keeping very busy and doing a good job, I suppose.
I mean, one of the things with bass is, I mean, you have to be disciplined. And you said you read music. And of course, you know, bass and drummers, you know, that's the engine room of any band.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, it's not required that you read. I think it helps, and I definitely recommend it. There are a lot of great players that haven't and didn't, but it has helped me. But yeah, bass is not just a guitar with less strings. It's a whole different world. And honestly, even though it was quick for me, I mean, I'm still figuring it out. There's still things to always learn, and really knowing what the bass is all about. I mean, I had my influences. I love John Deacon of Queen, and then there was a bass player called Jaco Pastorius, a fretless bass player that influenced my wanting to play fretless, and on, but it just keeps evolving, and I still have my first Fender Precision bass. That's what you heard actually on Roundabout there. Yeah. Fretted one. Had it since 76. And I still look at it with such just wonder and joy, like that moment when the lights opened up from the heavens. And it's like I still have that wonder and joy and just love for doing it. So I'm very thankful for that.
Talk me through the dark arts then, because, I mean, bass, you know, and I've known a few bass players in my time, you know, they're a certain breed, but fretless. I mean, there's a sound to it, there's a warmth to it, but blimey, you've got to be on your A game.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's... The frets are, like, to me, the training wheels, the crutches, if you like. They make it very easy to be in tune. And so you have a wide area, the whole area pretty much between the frets, where you can hit it anywhere and it will be in tune. Yeah, I'm generalizing there, but that's the scope of it. But when you play the fretless, you have to play basically where the fret was. And so you're taking the place of that. And so there isn't that wiggle room and room for error. And so, yeah, it takes a little time to get used to that. But, you know, I liken the fretless bass to the voice. Imagine if the voice had frets, it would be very stiff and robotic. And so the voice is very expressive, but we don't think about it. We just talk and we get excited and the voice goes up and we get sad and the voice is down. It's like that with the fretless. You have that very, it's limitless with just being able to express yourself and in subtle and little ways sometimes. It's not all about the novelty stuff and the big slides and that. It's still the bass. It still has the job to do of holding down the low end and maintaining the groove. But those little subtle inflections that make it so emotional and so just beautiful. It's, yeah, but it does. It takes time, especially in the beginning, to get used to that.
And I mean, a lot of people will think, you know, you're learning the bass, you're coming along with it. It's the late 70s. I mean, a lot of people are thinking, oh, blimey, well, it's punk, which is like three chords at the best of times. And then it's new wave. Not a great time for a bass player. And then we're into electronic music. But you sort of followed the you were influenced by the new wave of British metal, perhaps.
No, actually, not really.
Okay.
My influences, I mean, I played classical music and all sorts. I played big band. That's one of the advantages I had of coming from a musical family. My grandparents, in the evenings, we'd play selections from Gilbert and Sullivan. I'd be on the clarinet. I loved it all. And then I would learn ABBA. I would play along with Queen songs on the piano, not on the bass. I had just such a broad selection of music. And you know, I cannot underestimate Queen, because John Deacon, the unsung hero of the band, I mean, his bass lines were so adventurous and creative and often overlooked in the grand scope of what Queen was. But what he was doing, one of my YouTube videos, I do a soloed version of You're My Best Friend, and he's doing everything that you shouldn't do as a bass player. It's busy. He's playing high up. And he's almost like lead bass. And so, you know, I wasn't influenced by the British metal. I wasn't really into the punk scene, although I went to see The Damned at the Queen's Hall in Derby. And so I got into it in the Jam as well. So I got into that. But it was very broad, my musical upbringing and listening palette. So I think that definitely helped.
So how did the firm come around? And talk me through your 80s hairstyle as well, because I've seen some promotional pictures. We all had them. It was the 80s. I'm only jealous, you know.
Well, no, of course, it was part of the thing. It's well, I'll talk about the hair first, but it's because that's more interesting, isn't it? You know, it was one of those things, as you say, it was the 80s, and I really just wasn't thinking about the trends of the fashions. I never wore spandex. I never did any of the typical kind of things. I was wearing baggy trousers, like the genie thing, because they were comfortable.
Yeah.
And honestly, with the firm hairstyle, it was one of those things. It was the easiest thing to do because my hair was just out of control. It's like, what am I going to do? Just something that is easy to – it was very easy to maintain. People think I spent hours in front of the mirror, but it was just easy. It was one of those things, and it just kept going from there. And it was happened to be the fashionable at the time. It wasn't – we didn't think of it as a mullet back then. It was just – it was hair. And so now it's called I call it the mega mullet for fun. But yeah, definitely looking back, there's some wild dudes. But when you're on the road for a few months and your hair, you can see it at the beginning of the firm tour, all of us, the hair is kind of shorter, and then by the end of it, it's like this exploding dandelion haystack kind of thing.
There should be a book on hairstyles of the road, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the beginning and the end. I mean, now I'm sure people get haircuts along the way, or they take somebody with them. But back then, you didn't think of it. None of us did. Of course, Chris Slade was smart. He had the shaved head, so he was good. But the transition, wow. Well, I just kept busy, and different connections led to different things. I was playing in Birmingham at the Mecca Ballroom with a 10-piece dance band, Pete's People, playing three sets a night on a revolving stage. This was 1980, and the drummer in that band, connections. One just led to a session with Roy Harper, right. And you'll know who Roy Harper is.
Yep.
I mention him over here. Not a lot of people do. You even say that he's saying "Have a Cigar" on Pink Floyd's "Wish You Were Here." And like, really? I thought that was Roger Waters. And so, you know, but he was very connected with Pink Floyd, with Led Zeppelin, with The Who. I ended up doing a Chance recording session with him in Birmingham, and it's reconnected, and it just went from there. And fast forward to, I did a bunch of albums with Roy and quite a few shows. And fast forward to 84, he said, "Oh, I'm doing another album. Jimmy Page is going to be playing on it. Love you to come out." I said, "Be great." And so now you got to bear in mind that I was not aware or much of a fan of Led Zeppelin at that point.
Right.
That's a long story unto itself. But, yeah, I was not enamored by them. People say, "How did you hang with Paul Rodgers and Jimmy Page? I would have freaked out." I said, well, we were a band. It was very, very natural and very organic. And we just wanted to make a great album and put on a great show. And so it was very natural and comfortable. And so, yeah, we did a few gigs with that lineup, with Jimmy, with Roy, and Nick Green, who went on to be the future keyboard player of Blue Murder, and Steve Broughton from the Edgar Broughton Band. Now we're going back. And you know, Jimmy and I got along, and he called me and see if I wanted to sit in on the rehearsals of his new band. I wasn't asked to be in the band. Mm-hmm. I was asked if I wanted to come and sit in. And so, yeah, I did, and hey, the rest is history. It went well.
Yeah, it went well. You know, the you went on tour, and it's got sort of one of these cult followings, doesn't it? The band. I mean, you threw a picture up on Instagram, and suddenly people are saying, "Oh yeah, I had the album. I saw you play this, that, and the other." And it's quite, you know, because everybody thinks of the 80s as being sort of big hairstyles and big shoulder pads, and yours not accepted. There was, you know, that sort of some really great stuff coming out and some really great stuff on the road.
Absolutely, and it's still. I mean, the film was slated by the press, especially the British press when it first came out. You know, it was Jimmy Page, it's not Led Zeppelin. What do they call it? Bad Zeppelin, yeah. Bad Company, yeah. And Led Zeppelin. And so it was slated from the beginning. And so it kind of didn't get the fair, and fair enough. I mean, it was Jimmy's first outing since Led Zeppelin. The expectations were big. And so it wasn't that. And it wasn't Bad Co. It was its own thing. And to their credit, they did no Zeppelin and no Free or Bad Company, because they wanted this to stand on its own musical merits. And the shows were fantastic. I mean, God, I got a glimpse of the greatness of Zeppelin with that, because we would often do extended jams, and it would be back and forth, and with Jimmy and myself, I mean, three-piece band musically, and Paul would step aside, and we'd just jam out. It was magic, and you know, they were, and so I can imagine with a band like Zeppelin, they were so in tune with each other that you know, that kind of chemistry is rare, and it's so magic. And we had that with the film. We were exploring with the music. We were taking it to new places, and it was growing and evolving. And to me, that is so exciting. You never play the same song twice, really. Mm. So you're always evolving and growing. And you know, sadly, it didn't carry on. But it was magic. The shows, there's some great bootlegs out there. Even an early show, there's that Hammersmith show, which was like our seventh or eighth show. And the vibe and the chemistry was right there, even then. And so, yeah, it was just a real blessing and a privilege to be part of that, which I didn't fully appreciate or realize until many years later, to be honest, it's like, wow, I was 22, 23. How did that happen? And it was magic. And I put those pictures up and people give me such incredible comments, like, it was my first show. I play the fretless bass because of you. It's very humbling and very touching. And then people, yeah, they say, that was amazing music and all that. And you do lose perspective. It's something that you did yourself and you don't really have that objectivity. But I think it holds up. And I think if people can look at it past, look past the fact that it wasn't Zeppelin and it was Jimmy's first outing, on its own merits, it was actually pretty cool, I believe.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, I spoke to Steve Gorman, the drummer in the Black Crowes, and you know, and I went to see Mark Ford, who played a gig down here, the guitarist in the Black Crowes, and it was, people were saying, well, he didn't play any Black Crowes songs, but if you've done all that and you've done Stadium and you just want to play a little rock gig in a place or something different, you know, they've done it all. They don't need to do Zep, they don't need to do Bad Company or Free Again, do they? They just want to get out and gig.
Well, yeah. I mean, if they were going out as Led Zeppelin, then you'd have to do Led Zeppelin. But the thing was, it was the firm, it was its own musical entity, and they wanted it to stand on its own. Now, if we were to do it, I mean, imagine now, enough time has passed, we could go out and do some Led Zeppelin tunes. Paul would kill on that, just the choice ones, and make some nice arrangements of it, and do some Free, do some Bad Company, and mix that up with the firm stuff. I think it would be powerful and magic. And you know, whether that's going to happen, I'm not trying to hint at that.
But you heard it here first, yeah, and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm definitely not hinting, because nothing is in the ether about that happening. But I just reflect on it and think, wow, you know, that I'm glad we didn't do any Led Zeppelin stuff, because the truth is, I didn't know any. I went into that not knowing any Led Zeppelin. I didn't know who John Paul Jones was at the beginning. I didn't know what his role in the band was. So I went into it with a completely fresh approach. I did it all on fretless, and it turned out to be, in hindsight, a nice move, because it gave the band a bit of a different identity. At the time, it wasn't sort of, oh, let's do it all on fretless, let's do this. We just played. We did what we did. And it created its own unique chemistry. But now, yeah, you could really mix it up and have a lot of fun with that.
And I mean, after that, you sort of gigged and played and done, you know, records with practically everybody. I mean, Whitesnake, that must have been a great experience as well.
That was fun. Yeah, that was later. That was 97, and yeah. It was billed as their last hurrah, their final tour, which it was actually at that point. David took 5 or so years off, and I worked with him during that time, worked on his solo stuff, and he really took it as far as he could as a solo artist. But, you know, people wanted Whitesnake, and so they got back together again in 2003. They asked me to do it, actually, but I couldn't. At that time. And so, but yeah, a lot of fun. David and I are still great friends. We call each other Wallace and Gromit. it was a magical time. And I actually met David in 85 with the firm. And he actually drove Chris Slade and I to a gig in Costa Mesa down here in the White Jag, the one that ended up in the videos,
the
of course,
video, yes, the one that etched itself into the minds of 1,000,000,000 teenage boys.
That's right. We can still picture it right now, can't we? So it was. We'd known each other a long time, and we'd wanted to do something. So there it was. But there was a great, great time that was.
And I mean, I've had loads of emails in when we've been talking about this show coming up, but the one of the ones that came in from Sweden was talking about the short-lived but oh-so-amazing. This is from Orhan in Stockholm. Hope you bring up the short-lived but oh-so-amazing Blue Murder Project. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's funny. It wasn't as short-lived as people think, although it was publicly. I first met John Sykes in 87 through Cozy Powell, actually. He called me out of the blue. I didn't know who John Sykes was, and so Cozy called me, and said, you want to check this out? And I said, yeah. And John and I just got along right away, musically and personally. We had a great chemistry, and I liked the songs and all that. And Cozy ended up going his own way, and then we brought in, or Carmine Appice found us, actually, he'd heard. And so he came in, and it was instant. The chemistry was right there. It just fit musically. And so shortly after that, we were off to Vancouver in Canada and recording the album with Bob Rock, who'd done the Aerosmith and Bon Jovi albums and all that, and worked with John a little bit on the Whitesnake 87 album. And so John liked the sound that he got from that. And so, yeah, it was all this time, though, John did not want to sing. And so we were trying out different singers. Ray Gillen was part of it for a little while. Tony Martin from the Black Sabbath incarnation and all that. Yeah. And it just never felt right. And so it was close. I mean, we got along with those guys and we wanted it to work. Because John, playing lead guitar and singing is a monstrous undertaking, especially how John plays. And so finally we said, John, you just got to do this. And so he did, and he did a great job. And then came out in 89 and got a big splash, especially in the States and all that. And we did a bunch of gigs with that, and we went over to Japan and toured extensively in the States, sadly not in Europe. But you know, there's a lots of things and theories and circumstances as to why that did not break through, and I don't want to go into all that, but it was fantastic. I mean, that was another situation where we would jam out, and it would just be so exciting playing live, and then it ran out of steam, and 1990 came along. And And then 91 is when Nirvana came along. The whole musical scene changed, and it was done. It was done. I mean, there's a lot of factors and elements to that. And yeah, I'm actually writing a memoir because a lot of this stuff is so complex and so many influences and just changes that happen through all that. I mean, you know, it's people say, well, come on, get back together and do an album and do a tour. I'll ask the question myself that everybody wants to know about. But, you know, it's very easy to say that. And I get along. We all get along. We're friends. But here's the thing. Bands are like family. It's very complicated. It's very complex. And there's always a lot of ingredients to that. And it'd be like somebody coming around and saying to us, hey, why don't you get together with your ex and move in together and have a baby? And I'm like, yeah, right. That's not a good idea, but we're friends. We'll keep it that way. And so, you know, there's a lot of elements to it, plus the business and all that. And so I always say maybe, but truly at this point, it's not looking like it's going to happen. I mean, what, we're 30 plus years after it, and I highly doubt it. But you know, it's wonderful to feel and hear the enthusiasm that yes, it was short lived in the big picture of things, that people love that band, and it made such a big impression, and it was a great thing to be part of.
And also, I mean, going on the road, it's just the hype. I mean, I interviewed Carmen a while back, and he told me about going on the road with Rod Stewart and the Sex Police, and that was enough for anybody to put anybody off for life.
Well, you know, that was then. We're all in
now. It would be a bit different, obviously. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of fun. Don't get me wrong; it was wild. And of course, he's talking about the '70s then, so that was even wilder then. I mean, I caught the tail end of that with the '80s, and it was wild. Firm. We had our own plane. We had our own limos. We were staying in the best hotels, and it was fantastic. And Blue Murder was we were nuts. We were crazy. But you know, you can't do that these days. I mean, you got to remember, of course, that was all those days were the days before handheld videos and YouTube and you know, AIDS, of course. But you know, people, if you do something out of line these days, and that's not me anymore, but it's instantly there. What stays in Vegas, and what happens in Vegas ends up on YouTube now. So you know, it's not like it was. So, but honestly, it's now about the music and business. I mean, we can't, even though I'm a musician, that's what I do, it's still my business. And so you have to be very aware and not let things slip. It's a tough business to be in. People think it's all fun and games, but you know, it's business, and it's being very responsible and aware. So, but hey, gosh, great stories from that time. What can I say?
So, are you putting these down? Then this is the thing as well. You're penning them together.
I'm sorry. Please say again.
You're putting this. I hope you're putting this all down, because I mean, I know you're on the. Will you be? Are you going to be releasing the book? A book soon of your memoirs, though. And you know, are we going to catch up with the? You know, the tales of the Fretless Monster.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There'll be a lot of that. Even though, you know, honestly, it's not. I don't want to put a lot of the grungy sex, drugs, and rock and roll story. We've all heard those, and maybe people like it. But you know, there'll be a hint of that. But it's really about the journey. When I look at the big picture things and how things happen, how people come into your life and circumstances. I mean, in 87, I was offered to do the gig with Pink Floyd. I'd done a gig with David Gilmour and Kate Bush, actually. That's on YouTube, too. We did Kate's Running Up That Hill at the London Palladium as part of the Secret Policeman's third ball. It was fantastic, and David asked me. I mean, they just got the Pink Floyd name back, and Roger was no longer on board, and they wanted a bass player. And I was on a short list of three guys. There was Pino Palladino, Tony Levin, and myself.
Wow, that's a list. That's a list and a half.
No kidding, yeah. And it's a long story. I couldn't do it. I had to say no. It was heartbroken. And but, you know, life from there took me in a direction that we can't anticipate how it would have gone if it had have gone the other way. But I can certainly appear and say, wow, you know, you just never know. Interesting signposts, if you like, or turning points. And it's going to be personal. It's going to be real. It's going to cover a lot of stuff that is very personal. I mean, bullying and all that kind of stuff that I dealt with. And, you know, that obviously is not rock and roll, but it shaped my life. And I don't dwell on that stuff a lot, but I touch on it because I think it's important, because I can see how it affected me and how it affected decisions and how it affected different things. But, you know, it's all part of the grand, wonderful rock and roll story that has been simply amazing, and it still continues. I'm not done yet. I mean, there's still a lot of things I want to do. I mean, my to-do list keeps getting longer. I'm going to have to live till I'm about 125 at this rate.
Yeah, that sounds about a fair bet if I were you. If people want to find out more about what you're up to at the moment, I know you're on social media, and I know that you've got a website. Where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm very active on social media. I like to handle all of it myself. I have nobody answering for me. It's all under Fretless Monster. The website is fretlessmonster.com. Instagram/fretlessmonster. Twitter/fretlessmonster. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Cameo/fretlessmonster. You know, the personalized videos and all that. And YouTube too, Tony Franklin, the Fretless Monster. And so I'm very active on there. It takes a lot to maintain it. And but I love doing it. In fact, I put a post and saying that, hey, if you don't hear from me, don't take it personally. I get a lot of things sent to me. I mean, you can't imagine the amount of videos and songs. Oh, will you please check out my song? Look at my basses and all that. I'm flattered that people want to do that, but you know, you can only do so much. But I'm very active, and I love to interact with the fans, and they're amazing.
Well, one of the fans has interacted with me here, Roger, also from Scandinavia. So you've got to do Sweden, because Sweden obviously loves you. Says, I see you're going to be speaking to Tony Franklin this afternoon. Wouldn't it be appropriate to play a song from the album Dying to Live? Fright.
Joel Hoekstra, right?
Yeah, absolutely, which Tony plays on, Tony being the former Whitesnake bassist and Joe Hoekstra being the current Whitesnake guitarist. And he's saying he thinks that Until I Left You is a great song. So I'm going to play out with that. Tony, it has been an honour and a privilege to speak to you today. Check out him on the Fretless Monster on all the social media platforms with that. And enjoy your Friday over in the States, my friend.
Thank you, Charles. It's been a real pleasure. Great chats and insightful questions. I really appreciate your time. And thanks to everybody who follows along. And I appreciate you all. And I'll look for you on the internet.
Tony Franklin, thank you so much for your time today.